Each month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics does a household survey to evaluate the job market. The BLS calls 50,000 households in the last week of the month and asks whether anyone who lives in the house got a new job or lost one. Now, what's challenging about this is that net employment change is often less than 1 in 1,000, so small differences is what we're looking for. And I think what you're saying, Daniel, is that the specific survey questions might be insufficient.
When someone in a household gets asked whether they worked in the previous week, they may say no. But that doesn't mean that they're not in the labor force. If you're someone who decides to work full-time 1 week or maybe even more, 60, 80 hours 1 week, and then not at all the next week because that's how you like to do it, you like to go surfing the other week, let's say, then you're still working 30, 40 hours a week on average, but you're working 1 week on, 1 week off. Now, if the government happens to survey you during the week that you're surfing, they will say that's a person who's not in the labor force. But clearly that's not true because this person is working about 30, 40 hours a week on average. So there's this random element that's been introduced here. And as a result of that, miss what their working status is, we may be leaving them out of the labor force entirely.
Do you think these work apps have changed the labor market?
We have had this proliferation of these flexible work apps over the past couple of years. And I think part of that is because the pandemic created an opportunity in a couple of different ways. People may have been ill with COVID or barred from the workplace because of a COVID test. They may have had to take care of loved ones because of COVID. And a flexible schedule may have become more attractive as a result of that. Also, if your workplace has closed down for some reason or you're on furlough, you may not be looking for a permanent position, but you might be looking to make some extra cash. Working shifts here and there while you wait for your layoff or your furlough to end could have been a viable way to continue earning income for some people. And so what we've just seen in the pandemic has only accelerated what the technological way it started.
Do you think the nature of work is changing? I mean, in old societies, you would work for one firm for your whole life, or work in one industry or job function for a lifetime. And now you can mix things up on a moment's notice.
The definition of a job has definitely changed over time. It used to be that a job was a full-time permanent position, or even a part-time but still permanent position, where you expected to go to work every week. If somebody does a couple of shifts over a couple of weeks at the same business, is that a job? What if they get a three-month assignment? Is that a job? We don't even really have many contracts anymore. Most people are in at-will employment anyway. It's not as though people even on a more permanent position have that much more job security.
Would you suggest changing the household survey questions to deal with the changing nature of work?
I referred earlier to the hourly paid workers that the census counts. That's where the 6 million number came from, 6 million that were missing since the pandemic began. Now, hourly paid just comes from one survey question on the household survey where they ask, are you regularly paid, hourly, weekly, monthly, et cetera? Now, somebody answering that question might say, well, gee, I don't know. I mean, I worked and I had an hourly rate, but I get paid based on the number of tasks I complete, or I get paid because I did a shift over a course of 4 days. Does that count as hourly paid? There's too much room to be able to interpret it in different ways.
The employment market is hard to measure. How could you evaluate labor supply or labor demand? We have both public and private surveys to help us. We can see that we have hiring signs in every storefront, and we know that the labor market is tight. And the labor market is akin to many markets, which is opaque. So the one thing that all markets have in common is price. And if prices are rising, then there is either an increase in demand or a reduction in available supply, or both. Well, wages are surging, up 5.7% year on year. What do you make of wage inflation as a proxy for labor market dynamics?
There have been labor supply shortages at times, especially during the most recent Omicron wave of COVID-19. And we saw on our platform, where we have real-time transaction data from the labor market, that wages did increase very quickly during that period. We had more firms that were filling shifts on short notice and offering higher wages. We expect some of that heat to come out of the market now. But we did see over the year, even up to November 2021, that there was a really dramatic increase in wages, especially for these hourly professionals, that far exceeded the levels of inflation that were measured by the government. Companies don't necessarily like to raise wages, but once they've done it, it's very hard to cut them. So we're unlikely to see a decline in wages. What people will be more looking for is to see whether real wages decline with time if companies then postpone other raises that they might have planned into the future.
Vittorio Saff spoke on what happens next in March 2020. And he said that due to the government's forced closure of restaurants related to COVID, Serafina had to terminate 1,000 employees. And when I asked Vittorio, would it be easy to rehire these workers? He said it would be incredibly difficult because his former employees would likely move all over the world.
People have been dislocated. It's hard to bring people back. We've seen it even country to country. You know, people who were expatriates decided to go home to their home country so they could be with family before quarantine restrictions would even prevent them from doing that. And the idea that they would suddenly return the moment the office was ready to reopen is silly. So I think there's certainly some of that contributing to the increases in wages too, because if, let's say, you have a high-end restaurant and it took you a long time to hire a very professional staff, and now you've lost some of those people, but all of a sudden you have to recover the staff quickly, well, how are you going to get really high-quality professionals on short notice? You have to pay a high wage. There's a secondary effect, which is if you start offering a high wage, you're going to get a lot of applications from everybody, not just the high-end professionals. So it comes down to your ability to discern those high-end professionals.
Before the pandemic, many older workers were semi-retired. They worked, I don't know, 1 or 2 days a week. Let me give you an example. One of my dad's best friends is a doctor who shares a nurse with a few other semi-retired doctors, and they had office hours once or twice a week. And the economics justified buying medical malpractice insurance. When the pandemic hit, it no longer made sense to continue, and the doctors closed their medical office permanently. Do you think that COVID encouraged permanent retirement of semi-retired workers?
The story about the elderly has some credence to it. There's no doubt that we've seen a decline in labor force participation in that demographic. We don't have that many elderly signups relative to other age groups on our app, and that may be a function of technological literacy as well as the will to work.
With kids going to school from home, a parent needs to be nearby. It's like my mom, and that suggests that women would be more likely to drop out of the workforce to take care of the youngsters. Once kids went back to school, women may be lax to re-enter the workforce. Now, we've not seen a substantial shift of men to women in the national employment statistics. What are you seeing in your app?
The mothers, that's something that we have a little bit of insight about. We actually get more women than men signing up for InstaWork, but we actually have more men than women working shifts. The ones who can actually go and show up, because these are mostly in-person occupations that they're doing, have been slightly more men than women. And you could hypothesize that it has something to do with childcare.
Do you suspect that childcare requirements might apply to fathers as well, and that may explain some of the decline in worker participation rates?
Maybe some of the men are having to do childcare and other home caring as well. That's keeping them in the home. We know that this has been an incredibly taxing time for families. Can you imagine sitting at home trying to work remotely while one child needs help with their schoolwork on the iPad, and then the other child who's younger has nothing to do, and you feel your heart being torn out as you see that other child basically having to fend for themselves? It's incredibly difficult, and there has been a lot more need for attention in the home. As the pandemic recedes, some of these pressures will dissipate a little bit. These dislocations in the economy, these shocks, can move us into different professions, different roles that we might not have considered before. I've certainly read plenty of stories of people who said, well, I finally decided to just follow my passion. You know, my workplace closed, so I decided to try something else. And so I think we're seeing a lot more fluidity, you know, what some people might call creative destruction in a different sort of way in the economy, and those changes are likely to stick.
Nobel Prize winner Ronald Coase wrote an essay entitled The Firm that makes the argument that the reason firms exist is because of transaction costs related to employment, ongoing relationships with customers, and suppliers. His idea is that in a perfect world without transaction costs, customers would find workers to solve their problems seamlessly without the need of a firm. But because it's really hard to negotiate daily employment or individual task-based contracts, firms exist to hire workers for the long term to provide labor to customers. But as technology reduces these transaction costs, we would expect customers to transact directly with workers, and that workers would move towards an individual task-oriented labor contract in lieu of lifetime employment with a single firm.
There's no doubt that transaction costs play a very important role in the nature of the firm, and as you say, to have to recontract all your workers every day, all your suppliers, your labor is just one of the inputs that goes into whatever you're making. So to have to do that every day would be kind of wild. But then when you look at it from the B2C perspective, you also say, well, consumers want to have a firm that they can continue to return to, and they'll have some expectations about the product and the timing of the service delivery that they'll get. Transaction costs by themselves aren't the only justification for the existence of firms. We want them from the consumer's perspective as well. When you look at the labor market, eliminating these frictions where you have buyers and sellers that will make the markets more efficient.
Firms need skilled employees, and they will invest to make employees more productive. But if the firm invests in general skills, the employee will get most of the benefits because otherwise he can quit and join another company. But if the skills are firm specific, then the firm gets the benefits. How do you think about job training in this new world of task specific contractual relations and little affiliation with the firms?
One of the problems and one of the reasons why firms underinvest in training is that they're afraid in our at-will employment market that somebody will just pick up those skills and then leave, and they won't get any compensation. However, it doesn't work like that in every market. For example, in international soccer, you're required by the administrative body's rules to pay a compensation fee to a club that has trained a young player when that young player moves to a different club. It makes sure that the clubs still invest in the training of young players and that those clubs that pick up the young players all over the world can stay in business. I think that we should have something like that. If a firm trains you where you get some sort of certification that you've picked up a skill, then that should come with a fee when the worker changes employers. Now, that's inserting a friction into the labor market that wasn't there before. But you are solving this problem of underinvestment in training.
Last October, Claudia Golden, a Harvard professor of economics, joined us. Besides being the former head of economics department at Harvard, she was also my teacher at Penn, where I was her student in an introduction to microeconomics course. Claudia has some new research on why women make less than men for similar work. Claudia suggests that some work requires flexible work hours. Work needs to be done off hours, on short notice, far from home. And that work is problematic for women who have childcare responsibilities and thus garners higher per hour wages. I think what's exciting about these apps is that women can match their skills with a flexible work environment and take that higher paying work when it is available and suitable for them. How do you think about flexibility and gender-based compensation?
Well, the apps offer our hourly professionals lots of options of when to work, where to work, and how to work. But it doesn't change what the worker's own constraints are. If they wouldn't work that time in a conventional job, then they might not want to work that same time in a flexible job. But what it does allow them to do is to create their own schedule. And so hopefully it creates more economic opportunities by allowing them to earn a higher income within the constraints that they already face. Claudia's an old professor of mine. I had her at Harvard as a grad student.
It's amazing the power and influence that a great professor or teacher like Claudia Golden can have on their students over a lifetime in terms of insight, enthusiasm for a field, and skill building. Frictions in the employee-employer relationship include knowing the true skills of the employee and whether the employer is trustworthy, accurately pays for performance, and excels at training.
So back in 2009, I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post called "The Future of Journalism is eBay." I had spent several years as a journalist at that point, and it seemed to me with the increasing use of freelancers that we were headed in a direction where we would just have buyers and sellers who would transact pieces on a marketplace, and people would have reputational scores, both the editors and the reporters. The editors could put out calls for pieces that they wanted to attract, and the reporters could similarly post pieces that they'd written or pitches that they had for bidding. And I think that we certainly could run into this area for things like journalism where you're kind of working on a piecework basis, right? But for something that's a bit more involved, where you have longer term projects and they're not as easily defined, it might not be quite so easy to do this. You want to build long-term relationships. We find on InstaWork that firms will work with a professional a couple of times, then they'll start requesting that professional on a shift basis, and eventually they will hire that professional on a full-time basis in-house. And that's something that we love to see because it means someone's getting a better opportunity and job security as well.
The biggest disconnect in the labor market is that it is national and not international in scope. We cannot get a haircut from someone who lives in Mexico unless he moves here. But work that can be done remotely opens up opportunities for overseas workers. Now, this is fabulous for customers because the task will be much cheaper. It'll be great for overseas workers because they can earn more money. And it'll be a catastrophe for domestic workers who have to compete with labor from the third world. How will your apps put customers or domestic firms in contact with individuals outside the United States?
It's a very interesting question because when we start to move full-time jobs, the type of permanent positions that the government usually likes to monitor and regulate, towards offshore and remote work, then we could run into some legal implications. I can certainly see that for remote work, it's happening already. Certainly at InstaWork, we employ people all over the world because we're looking for the best talent wherever we can find it. It doesn't have to be on a freelance basis, but some firms may decide that that's the best way for them to go to reduce red tape. It's just a question of how much the government will tolerate it.
I end each session on a note of optimism. Daniel, what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic that we're going to continue to chip away at frictional and structural unemployment, which are two of the toughest types of unemployment to eliminate in the economy, because frictional unemployment has to do with the way the labor market actually works, and structural unemployment has to do with the mismatches that we see between skills and the need for work. I think that apps like InstaWork can continue to use technology to eliminate the frictions, and hopefully policymakers in Washington and the states will do more to eliminate the structural problems that we have by helping workers to retrain and get the education and skills they need to be productive.